This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. A wounded Union captain from Vermont and the resilient wife of a Confederate soldier cross paths and fates. This is the premise of Weybridge author Chris Bojalian's new novel, The Jackal's Mistress. Bojalian is the New York Times best-selling author of 25 books, a playwright, and a longtime Addison County resident. His work has been translated into 35 languages and become three movies and an Emmy-winning TV series. You might have seen The Flight Attendant on Max. That's based on his book. Another one of his novels was an Oprah's Book Club selection. He was also a weekly columnist for the Burlington Free Press from 1992 through 2015. Chris and I sat down together last weekend in front of a packed house at the Town Hall Theater in Middlebury. He was launching his book tour for The Jackal's Mistress right here in Vermont in partnership with the Middlebury Bookshop. We had a wide-ranging conversation that we'll share with you today. Later in the show, we'll hear about some of the animated shorts, international features, and even an Oscar-winning film coming to Montpelier this weekend as part of the Green Mountain Film Festival. But first, here's my conversation with Chris Bojalian. Hope you enjoy. We're on your home turf.
I love being on my home turf, and I'm so grateful to be on Vermont Edition, to be chatting with you. And I love looking into the Town Hall Theater and seeing so many friendly faces. I love this state.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful place. And what a great place to launch your book tour for The Jackal's Mistress. 25 books.
What I find even more impressive isn't that I have written 25 books, but I've survived 35 book tours and still standing. I mean, I have vomited on so many planes, on so many book tours, in front of so many readers.
Okay, and you had to explain this to me backstage. You don't have 10 ghost books that we haven't heard of. You've been on 35 tours because...
Because there was a long period when I would also do book tours for the paperback.
So, The Jackal's Mistress, as I've said, it's your 25th book. And I was reading somewhere that the idea for this book actually dates back about two decades when you first heard a story from a Reader's Digest editor that became the basis of this book. Can you tell us that origin story?
Absolutely. In 2003, a wonderful guy named Gary Sledge at Reader's Digest said, "Have you heard a story about a Vermonter in the Vermont Brigade in 1864 who was saved by a rebel woman?" And I said, "I have not." And he said, "Okay, it's kind of near you because all of the papers are at Middlebury College. Would you be interested in writing about this for the magazine?" And at the time, when I'd written for Reader's Digest, I'd written all of those really gory dramas in real life. Those six-page stories about people who are surviving shark attacks. And so this seemed like an interesting change of pace. I said, sure, and I dove in, and I loved it. And I loved reading about the story, not simply because the soldier, Henry Bedell of the Vermont Brigade, was unbelievably heroic, but because the woman who saved his life in Virginia was even more courageous. And we all know those tropes about the heroic soldier and, you know, the woman he leaves behind. This is kind of the opposite. It's a story, it's kind of a Civil War Romeo and Juliet about the North and South and a weakened man. He's had a leg amputated by surgeons. He's been left to die by Sheridan's army as they move deeper into the valley. And he's saved by two formerly enslaved people and a young woman whose husband is lost somewhere to the Union POW camp, and she makes this decision. "I am going to save his life if I can, because I would want a Yankee woman to save my husband's life if the situation was reversed." And this was an act of spectacular courage, because this is a part of the Shenandoah Valley filled with John Mosby's Confederate Rangers who, weeks later, would be hanging George Armstrong Custer's cavalrymen. This is a part of the Shenandoah that is changing hands all the time. And so she not only has to try and keep this Vermonter alive, She has to keep him hidden from all of the rebels and all of the Confederate soldiers and all of the Confederate Rangers who are everywhere.
Hmm. Were you a Civil War buff before starting this book?
I don't think it is possible to grow up in the United States male of a certain era and not be a Civil War buff. Now, I wasn't an expert on it beginning this book by any stretch of the imagination. I couldn't tell you the chronological order necessarily of Antietam, Chancellorsville, and Fredericksburg, but there are so many Vermonters who can. There are wonderful Vermont historians like Howard Coffin, who read an early draft of this book, and I remember him saying to me early on, "Chris, you don't get this right. People will tell you." They know this war. And a guy like Ken Borey. Ken Borey is a family physician in Randolph, Vermont, who is sweet and gentle and kind and everything you want in a family medicine doctor. But he's really interested in Civil War medicine because one of his ancestors was a Union hero at Chancellorsville. And not only does he have his ancestors' saber, but he also has so many bone saws.
He doesn't use them, does he?
No. Okay. He only shows them to novelists, apparently, are really interested in this. I mean, you make no mistake, the book, The Jackal's Mistress, is not a Civil War version of the movie, The Substance. It's not really terrifyingly grotesque, but there is some Civil War medicine. And Civil War medicine is only slightly more developed than cave people medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Actually, it might be worse than cave people medicine because they did have bone saws.
So you learned about this and you said, yep, that's for me.
I want
this in my book.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, going back to the Reader's Digest story. So I write this essay for Reader's Digest in 2003. And I think I'm done with the subject. The article runs and I'm happy with it and it's great. I didn't write historical fiction back then. Cut to 2022. I am in Richmond, Virginia, on a book tour, and Richmond is one of those cities where you feel the weight of American history and the Civil War in ways you certainly don't in Vermont. I mean, in Vermont, the closest thing we had to a Civil War battle was a really bad, failed bank robbery in St. Albans. That was the extent of our Civil War battlefields. But in Richmond, you feel it. Mm-hmm. And I thought of that article I'd written 19 years earlier. When I finished the book tour, I revisited that article, and I thought, if there's any time in your life when you should write a book about the North and the South, about a divided country, and two people on both sides of the divide with this really strong moral compass, this is the moment. And so I made it my next book and started writing. And I loved writing this book because I fell so in love with my fictional versions of the actual people.
This might be a weird question. Do you ever dislike your characters so much that you can't spend more time with them and you have to change them? Is it difficult to write a very unlikable character?
Yeah, I've written characters who are evil. I've had characters in my book who commit genocide. I've had a serial killer in one book. I've had senior citizens who kill small children for their blood in another book. So apparently I don't mind it. Apparently, I mean, I'm not necessarily down with that behavior.
I don't know what you do in your spare time.
Well, I mean, what was it? I don't know if Jay Prini's in the house today, but one of my favorite authors is Jay Prini. And one of the things that Jay and I have talked about when we talked, because, you know, Jay is one of the reasons why I first was courageous enough to try and write historical fiction. It was when we were talking about his wonderful novel, Benjamin's Crossing. And there are a lot of really evil people in fiction. And I think it was, you know, reading Jay's book that I first realized it's okay to put people who are not morally complicated in a book, but to have some people who are just god-awful. Mm. Was it Milton who said that if the devil didn't exist, poets would have to invent him?
Well, let's return to the Civil War, because as you mentioned, Virginia is so steeped in Civil War history. I grew up in Virginia, and it felt like you couldn't turn around without running into one of those roadside historical markers. The battlefields are everywhere. Here in Vermont, it's different. The war wasn't in Vermont's backyard in the same way that it was in much of the South, but there still is so much Civil War history here. What did you learn when researching this book about Vermonters' role in the Civil War that interested or surprised you?
Yeah. One of the things I loved about this book is the conflation of fiction and history. Maybe a quarter mile from where we are sitting is the library at Middlebury College. And in the special collections is a little book from 1869 by Middlebury's valedictorian from 1862, Aldous Walker. It's called The Vermont Brigade in the Shenandoah Valley. And I fell in love with the Vermont Brigade and what Vermonters did in the Civil War in that little book. And there are two footnotes to the book that I find fascinating. First of all, Walker is the valedictorian in 1862. By the time the war ends 3 years later, he's a lieutenant colonel in the Vermont Brigade because so many officers are dead.
Yeah.
The Vermont Brigade was unbelievably heroic in so many different battles, but a lot of the Vermont Brigade didn't even see battles until 1864. You know, some were at Gettysburg, and some were really important in Gettysburg. But the Vermont Brigade people in my novel are basically in Washington, D.C., at the fort protecting the Capitol until Ulysses S. Grant says, no, we need these people in the field. So suddenly they're at Cold Harbor. Suddenly they are in the Third Battle of Winchester. Suddenly they are in all of these incredible battles in the summer and fall of 1864 when Grant made the decision, come hell or high water, we are going south. Going back to Aldous Walker. So here's a footnote I love. Henry Bedell in real life has most of his leg blown off by Confederate cannon fire. He should have died on the battlefield, but Aldous Walker is the person who takes Bedell's canteen cord and makes a tourniquet on his upper thigh, allowing him to live long enough to get to the field hospital where his leg will be amputated. Walker doesn't mention this in his book. You learn that in other letters because Walker is such a modest, decent guy. He recounts this story of Henry Bedell and this rebel woman who he will learn later saves his life, but he never mentions that, hey, I'm the guy under cannon fire who saves a guy's life by figuring out how to make a tourniquet out of a canteen cord. And that's the kind of human being that I think Walker was. He passed the bar in two states. So in The Jackal's Mistress, my main two characters are a man and a woman. The man is Jonathan Weybridge, Easter egg for all of us in Addison County. But Jonathan Weybridge has the wounds and the physical size of Henry Bedell, but the voice of Middlebury College valedictorian Aldous Walker.
Okay, I want to hear more about this research, because when I was reading the book, you mentioned some books I had heard of, like Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. But you also mentioned a couple mid-19th century deep tracks that I had to Google, including a book, I hope I pronounced this correctly, Macaria by Augusta Jane Evans. Some of you might know of this book. I did not, but it was a story about women in wartime that was a huge bestseller during the Civil War.
In the South.
In the South,
in
yes.
The South.
Tell us a little bit more about this book and others that influenced your writing.
Well, when you're writing historical fiction, you've got your ambient noise. the stuff that isn't necessarily integral to the plot, but makes it more vivid for readers. When I was reading the primary sources from the 1860s, I wanted to understand, what is my heroine? In real life, her name was Betty Van Meter. In my novel, she's named Libby Stedman. What would Libby Stedman in the novel, the fictional Libby, have been reading? So you get a sense of Libby Stedman's moral compass, but also so readers can see what kind of propaganda are Southern readers devouring as their world, with cause, is falling apart.
We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll hear how Chris Bohjalian sees our current political divisions after spending so much time researching the Civil War. This is Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, we are sharing a conversation with the Weybridge author Chris Bohjalian. His books have been made into movies and a TV show, and one was an Oprah's Book Club pick. His 25th book, The Jackal's Mistress, comes out this week from Doubleday. This interview was recorded live over the weekend at the Middlebury Town Hall Theater in conjunction with the Middlebury Bookshop. Let's dive back in with Chris answering a question I had asked him about how his research into the Civil War has influenced his perspective on the current political and social divides facing the United States.
I think it was 2016, but it might have been 2017. I heard David McCullough talking to Terry Gross on Fresh Air. And David had a great laugh. And Terry asked him, David, speaking as a historian, have you ever seen this nation as divided as we are right now? And with that great laugh of his, he said, oh, Terry, there was that dust up in 1861 and 1968 wasn't pretty. And in the last few years, I've tried to take comfort from that. There are parallels that are appalling. The whole idea that we'd reached this, what I thought was really smart, beautiful reckoning with history, that we understood that all of those men who had statues built to them on Monument Avenue in Richmond were treasonous. They had slaves. And the nation, this nation, should not have statues to people like that. So I was really, really disappointed when I see that there is a whole swath of Americans who want those statues back and those forts named after Confederate generals, even the Confederate generals who were terrible generals, guys like Bragg. The difference between now and 2016 might be that there's a whole swath of people who are really comfortable, not simply with racism, discrimination, cruelty, pettiness, but are really fond of oligarchy as well.
Chris, you're clearly, from talking to you and from reading your work, a person with a deep well of empathy and someone who spends a lot of time thinking, hey, what would it be like to go through life as this other person, somebody who might be very different from you. I've noticed that a lot of your main characters, including in The Jackal's Mistress, are women. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that choice. I mean, you started your writing career writing essays for Cosmopolitan magazine, a magazine mostly read by women. When you were writing, were you thinking of the audience or just thinking of what you wanted to write?
When I was, okay, most of what I wrote for Cosmopolitan, I wrote to pay the mortgage. I really needed those Cosmopolitan checks. And I wrote such important stories for Cosmopolitan, like herbal aphrodisiacs, emotional infidelity. Is it okay if he's with you in person but with her in his mind?
I mean, I would click.
Yeah. Why does he? Oh, my favorite was, why does he become such a beast at a bachelor party? So, but the very first short story I ever wrote Never the first thing I ever sold in my life was a short story to Cosmopolitan magazine.
Right.
I was writing all of these short stories for the New Yorker and Harper's and being summarily and consistently rejected. So I'm writing these short stories, and when I got rejection slip number 250, I thought to myself, huh, plan A, not working. And at the time, Cosmopolitan was publishing a lot of fiction. So I rounded up 6 months worth of Cosmos, read them thoroughly to try to understand what constituted a Cosmo short story. And then I wrote one. And because it was for Cosmo, it was from the perspective of a woman. And it was the first time I ever wrote across gender. And Cosmo bought it. It's actually in sort of an important issue of Cosmo historically, as far as these things go, not because it is my first short story. Cosmo is known for as a magazine that's, you know, kind of sexy. There's that period when Walmart wouldn't put him at the front checkout register, but only one time has Cosmo ever had frontal nudity in it. And of course, it's the issue that I'm in. That's funny. My mother was so proud. Anyway, so I clearly had a comfort level writing across gender, for whatever the reasons. The first time I ever wrote a novel across gender was Midwives, my fifth book, narrated by a early 30-something OBGYN whose mom was a Vermont midwife. And one of the things I found when I write across gender, going back to what you were saying about empathy, is because your gender is way more interesting than my gender, and because the stories I write are often a deep dive into the sort of emotions that guys of my generation are supposed to repress, the books are better when I write across gender. The narrators are more empathetic, and I think they're more interesting. And so in The Jackal's Mistress, which is a third-person, omniscient, you know, Henry Jamesian novel, there are actually five different perspectives, but the lion's share of the perspectives are Vermont Brigade Captain Jonathan Weybridge and the Shenandoah Valley's Libby Stedman, who is trying desperately to keep it together, running her husband's grist mill in his absence, trying to keep her and her niece and two formerly enslaved people who are working with her at the grist mill from starving, and hoping to God that her house doesn't become part of a battlefield. Hmm. But, you know, I hope fundamentally it's a page-turner and a love story.
Yeah. Do you like writing love stories?
I love writing love stories, but clearly, based on what we were talking about earlier, I'm also really comfortable writing about serial killers.
They don't have to be mutually exclusive.
No, they don't, you know. But I do love writing love stories. And one of the things I've discovered since March of 2020, when the pandemic started, is whenever I finish a book, right, whenever I finish reading a book or listening to a book on audio, because I'm in the woods with my dog, Jesse, or I'm walking Jesse even in Middlebury, all of a sudden, I will get really, really weepy. And I think it has something to do with how ephemeral life is, how we were all changed by the pandemic, and how beautiful art is, whether it's a book, a photograph, a painting, a play. I mean, I love the fact that we're in this town hall theater, this great community multi-generational center. It's just such a great celebration of art. And in 2025, as weird as our country is right now, I think we need art and fiction more than ever.
The pandemic was a very prolific time for you. You wrote a lot while in lockdown, right?
I did write a lot. Since March of 2020, I finished Hour of the Witch. I wrote The Lioness. I wrote The Princess of Las Vegas. I wrote The Jackal's Mistress. I wrote my 2026 novel, The Amateur, and I wrote a play, The Club. But I'm not...
We all did too, so it's not a big deal.
But I am not unique. We were chatting a little bit about this. I mean, I think we're in the midst of this glorious post-pandemic fictional renaissance, rather like the post-influenza pandemic renaissance of the 1920s. When I think of the great books that were written in lockdown, you know, Demon Copperhead and Chain Gang All-Stars and Tom Lake and Pineapple Street and, you know, Romantic Comedy by Curtis Sittenfeld. These are all books that were written during the pandemic. And it's just glorious to be a reader in 2025. My to-be-read pile in my house is it's just a series of Jenga towers in every room. It's great.
You brought up midwives earlier, and you've had a couple of books that were adapted for the big screen, including Midwives, which was made into a TV movie starring Sissy Spacek in 2001, and The Flight Attendant was made into a show on Max in 2020. Is it hard to let go of a work, something that you spent so long crafting and handed over to other creators to change as they might see fit?
It is so easy. I mean, when I finish a book, I am really done with it. For example, and I dive in to a book, heart and soul. When I finished Midwives in 1996, I think I could have caught a breach in a bedroom. When I was researching The Night Strangers, because it begins with a plane crash in a water in Lake Champlain, I went into a dunk tank with naval aviators for a full day and had the best time in my life because they reconfigured the dunk tank for a 70-seat regional jet. And, you know, I got to be in this pretend jet underwater. It was fantastic. But when I'm done with a book, I'm on to the next.
Yeah.
So when somebody in Hollywood wants to turn one of my books into a movie or a TV series, I'm in heaven. It's going to have another life. I don't need to work on it. I can go to the set and eat blueberries and bagels and, you know, sit in what is called the video village, trying to stay out of the way and not touch anything. And it'll give you one moment. That just was so lovely. Kaley Cuoco is a great actor. And one of the reasons why I was so thrilled that she was doing The Flight Attendant was because it was going to show the world that she has both great dramatic and comedic acting chops. And one of the days I was on the set was when they were filming the scene in the first episode where Cassandra Bowden, my flight attendant in the novel, discovers that the guy she hooked up with the night before is dead and is covered in blood. And when she goes into the bathroom, she's walked all over a broken glass bottle and left blood everywhere. And when they were filming that scene, I would watch Kaylee weeping on the floor of the bathroom, talking on the cell phone to her brother, which, you know, part of the script, and do it over and over. And each take was magnificent. I thought, this is just so beautiful. I love this. And I couldn't believe I had anything to do with the original source material.
It takes a lot to be an author in this modern era. You don't just get to sit in a nice cabin and write your books by candlelight and ship it off. You are also, you go on these book tours, and you've also had to learn the art of social media.
I am the oldest human being on TikTok. And the only one who isn't using it to, you know, to spy on people.
Have you found any, have there been any hidden joys in that part of the work? Or is it simply just what you got to do to be able to keep writing and doing what you love?
Here's the weird joy. and it's real. I love looking at the pictures I happen to post or the videos I happen to post that either include Victoria or Grace or Jesse, my dog, or Nugget, my cat. And I love the fact that because of TikTok and Instagram and all the other 1,900 social networks I'm on, there's this lovely archive of me and Victoria and me and Grace and me and Jesse and me and Nugget.
Hmm. Oh, you're making a scrapbook as you go.
It is. Yes, it is. It's a really interesting video scrapbook, suddenly. I mean, no one is ever going to write a biography of me, but, you know, someday there's going to be someone who's going to need to know something about Vermont writers in 2025, and they're going to say, okay, that guy had a really cute dog. Look at Jesse.
All right, well, if you have questions, call on up. I'm going to keep going because I got a lot more.
So my name is Sherilyn Rehm. I'm intrigued by you and your writing. So if you were not going to be an author, would you want to be something else, or would you always want to be an author in your inspirations? Where did they come from?
If I weren't an author, if I could be anything in the world I could be, I would either be a Broadway tenor or a Major League Baseball pitcher. Those are my two fantasy occupations if I can't be a novelist.
I wanted to be a shortstop, so maybe we could start a team.
Does Vermont Public have a team?
No, I'm working on it.
Do
I'm
it.
Working on it, yeah.
Do it. I can be like, you know,
we'll
you're Juan Soto parachuting in. Though I have less talent.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Christine Mayer, and I'm from Rochester, Vermont. I'm really curious if writing about serial killers and being writing about empathetic characters is not a challenge. I'm wondering what the most challenging part of your writing process is.
What a great question. The most challenging part of my writing process is sticking the landing at the end. I love the notion of the Aristotelian ending that is both absolutely surprising and absolutely inevitable. So when you finish the book, you think to yourself, wow, did not see that coming, but it couldn't have ended any other way. And sometimes I have stuck the landing, and sometimes I've had a 9.3 routine and then fell off the balance beams and wound up with a 7.
This one's a 10, though.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, Chris. This is Robert Fuller from Lincoln, Vermont. I'm proud to say that I knew Chris Wynn because he used to be a neighbor of mine in Lincoln, and I knew him before he got struck by lightning and became a member of the Oprah's book club. I agree with you about the importance of art, and I recently read Rob Merman's book, his memoir called A Circle of Sawdust. And in the book, you know, you may know, he became a mime. He studied with Marcel Marceau in Paris. They became friends. He performed here in Middlebury, Marceau did, in the late 90s with Circus Smirkus. And this is mentioned in the book. And after his performance, while he was still in costume, he held his finger up and got the audience to calm down. He brought all the performers out into the circle. And he said something I think is really profound and relates to what you said. Circus is loved the world over. And like music, it's the answer to nothing. But it touches the heart. And I think that's the importance of art. And I just wanted to reinforce what you said about it.
That's beautifully said. Robert is also one of the kindest human beings on the planet.
Takes one to know one.
Thank you.
I have one more question for you, Chris, before we have to wrap up this evening and go back into the cold. We talked a bit about the realities of being a writer in this modern era and what it takes to be able to do this professionally. As you head out onto this book tour, what is the role that small independent bookstores play in your career and in the communities that you get to visit?
Going all the way back to Cold Mountain to more contemporary books like Chain Gang All-Stars, Those are books built by booksellers who are deluged with galleys and champion a book. They see something in a book that really moves them or seems important to them, and they recommend it to their customers. And my career exists in very large measure because of booksellers at bookstores who picked up one of my galleys and liked it and recommended it to their readers. And that's one of the reasons why I love book tours. It's not just that I get to meet readers and feed my own pathetic, tawdry narcissism, but I get to say thank you to booksellers. Because, you know, no one goes into bookselling to get rich except for Jeff Bezos. He's literally the only human being who ever went into bookselling to get rich. 99.99999% of people in bookstores do it because they love books. We still have this totemic connection to books made of paper. Robert Fuller mentioned Lincoln, another great writer, and by another, I'm thinking of, you know, from this area, not referring to me, but was Roger Shattuck, great literary scholar. And I remember Roger Shattuck once talking to me about his books made of paper and the ones he did with him when he'd been in the Air Force in the Pacific Theater in 1944 and 1945, and how the smell of those books instantly catapulted him back into the jungle, and he cherished those books because he understood that as onerous and horrible as that work often was, it was work that was meaningful and important.
Chris Bohjalian, it has been an honor speaking with you this evening. Thank you.
Oh, Michaela, right back at you. Thank you for all that you do with Vermont Edition. My deepest thanks to Vermont Public for fighting the good fight on behalf of real news and real stories.
Thank you to the Middlebury Bookshop for partnering with Vermont Public on the event, to the Town Hall Theater for hosting us, and to Peter Engish for engineering the recording. Coming up, we're putting down our books and turning to the big screen for a preview of the Green Mountain Film Festival in Montpelier. This is Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. This weekend, organizers of the Green Mountain Film Festival are urging you to step out of hibernation and come together to watch a movie, or two, or ten. The Montpelier Festival screens independent films from our region and all over the globe. I recently spoke with the festival's programmer, Sam Kahn. They started off by explaining what's unique about the Green Mountain Film Festival when you compare it to other festivals in our region.
At the Green Mountain Film Festival, we really focus on programming really near and really far. So every year we have a strong showing of Vermont films by Vermont filmmakers. This year we've got a Vermont shorts block. We've got a selection of films from the Burlington Mothership Monthly Film Festival. We have Join or Die, which is edited by Chad Irvin, who is a local Montpelier filmmaker. And we also really strive to bring in voices that Vermonters aren't normally hearing from all over the country. Green Mountain Film Festival is also unique and special in that we have a really, really long history and legacy in the area. It was started in 1997, and although it's a new team, we're really building off of those many, many years of being in Montpelier at the Savoy Theater.
And I know last year was a big year for the festival because it marked the festival's return to Vermont after a four-year hiatus during the pandemic. And now you all are back bigger and better than ever.
Yeah.
So let's go through some of the films that you'll be featuring this year. I want to start with a film that folks might have heard of recently, if they hadn't already, because it just won an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. It's called No Other Land, and it's a documentary about a Palestinian activist and his community in the West Bank. Very few American theaters are screening it.
Hey, Ghassan El Qawwa.
أنا اسمي بس.
مسافر يطا هي المكان اللي كبرت فيه. بداية تصويري هي بداية نهايتنا.
جرفات؟
أنا متى أنا متخيل؟
tell us a little bit more about the film and the decision to screen it?
No Other Land is made by a collection of Palestinian and Israeli filmmakers. And it follows a young man named Basil, a Palestinian man in the West Bank, as he's defending his hometown of Masafer Yatta from destruction by the Israeli army. And it is an extremely moving and vital film. And I was struck by it, I mean, for many reasons, but not only do you witness the brutality of the violence, but you also see the contrast in the rights afforded to Basil and his friend, who's an Israeli journalist, Yuval. And you really see within this one friendship, this close friendship, how living under civilian rule as an Israeli citizen versus under military rule as a Palestinian, how that impacts the day-to-day moments of violence, but it's also what comes afterwards and what you do next. It was a film I had caught at the Camden International Film Festival in Maine and saw it in a packed audience and felt incredibly moved by it, incredibly impressed by the filmmaking, and just it's obviously a vital, vital voice to be hearing right now.
And this could be many Vermonters' only chance to see it in a theater. It sounds like the decision to screen this film came before it won an Oscar. What was it like to see that film that you selected get such a spotlight?
Really exciting. I think the Academy Awards have a lot of power in shedding light on films. They get a lot of attention. And so just to see this film that myself and a lot of other film lovers in the film festival community have been really excited about and also frustrated because it doesn't have distribution, to see the Academy give the film that spotlight was really exciting.
Mm. I'm also hoping you could tell us about a movie called Seeds, which might be of particular interest to the many Vermonters who work in agriculture.
Yeah, Seeds is a film by filmmaker Brittany Shine. It just won the U.S. Documentary Award at the Sundance Film Festival. And it's a gorgeous portrait of Black farmers in the South. It is shot entirely in black and white. And it traces a couple of Black farmers as they work the land and in their community, and also in protest as they work to get the same kind of financial assistance that white farmers are getting from the federal government.
I'm curious if you know what went into the decision to film it in black and white, or at least what the effect was as a viewer of seeing a movie like that in black and white.
As an audience member, every frame really is like a painting. The black and white cinematography gives it a sense, just emphasizes that legacy and history and the beauty of their community.
And there's an event associated with this screening, right?
Yeah, we're working with Liberation Ecosystem, formerly Vermont Relief, to host a panel of Black farmers discussing farming in our state.
Also of interest to many Vermonters might be the movie Ephes, about the last game of an adult recreational baseball league. And I saw that movie features the former Red Sox pitching ace and real Vermont personality, Bill Lee. What else should we know about this movie?
This film is wonderful. It is a real indie feature shot in New Hampshire. And it takes place over, like you said, the last game of a recreational baseball league. And I think this film, part of why it felt so meaningful to me to bring to Montpelier is because it really emphasizes the importance of local community, of those ties you have with your neighbors who maybe aren't your best friends, but you play a sport with, and how vital that is for just the quality of your daily life. It's also a beautiful piece of slow cinema. It really takes its time. It is unconventional in its humor, and that it's about a game, but there's no winning team or losing team. It's really about just the intimate moments you have with acquaintances and how important that ends up being for your life.
Pulled pork!
Hot
fresh pizza.
Parmesan cheese.
Macadamia nuts.
Marinara.
Pine nuts.
Yeah, not a lot wrong with that one, D.
You also have three animated films playing, A Boat in the Garden, Birds of a Feather, and The Colors Within. Is there one of those that stands out to you that you're particularly excited to share with the community?
They're all really wonderful. I want to highlight Birds of a Feather. It's a short film by a filmmaker, Katie Kobos, who recently graduated from RIT, so an emerging filmmaker. And it's about a young boy with Tourette syndrome who befriends a talkative parrot. And Katie really speaks about how she was looking for stories about characters who have disabilities that aren't about overcoming adversity, but are playful and sweet and just about the daily life of somebody with Tourette syndrome. And I really am excited about that approach to representation, to not just have stories about people who are struggling, but to have the story be central to the character's disability and be fun and playful and empowering.
The festival runs this weekend in Montpelier at the Savoy and the Capitol Theater and a number of other spaces around town. The Savoy is such a Montpelier landmark. I'd love to hear what's special to you about it.
Wow, yeah. It makes me kind of emotional because I care so much about local movie theaters, and because we've seen so many close in Vermont, with the Roxy Theater closing in Burlington and the Big Picture Theater in Waitsfield. And the Savoy is really, it just feels like one of the last places that is supporting and uplifting art house, independent international cinema in a way that is becoming more and more challenging in this country, when Hollywood is pushing the next Marvel movie to have access to small, independent, bold cinema. They're the kind of films that I grew up on, and being able to see those films in a theater with other people is so vital for creating community, for cinema education, for arts education, general access to culture. So I have a deep, deep love of the Savoy and its place in the Montpelier community.
And overall, Sam, what most excites you about the upcoming weekend and the Green Mountain Film Festival?
It's just like a treat to have people watch these films. They're movies that I've been working with my volunteer screening committee for the past 4 or 5 months to select. And when the audience finally sees the movie, hearing those reactions afterwards is amazing. Mm. Just by nature of being an international film festival, the festival does a lot of work to build international solidarity. You watch a film from Zambia or the West Bank or China and pretty quickly relate to it emotionally, relate to people's struggles and joys and desires all around the world. And I think a festival like the Green Mountain Film Festival can really remind us that we're all humans.
Sam Kan with the Green Mountain Film Festival, thank you so much for telling us about this exciting weekend.
Thanks for having me, Michaela.
All right, that is it for Vermont Edition today. Tomorrow, we bring you the second installment of our current weekly series, Animal Hour. We'll be talking big cats, like lynx and the elusive catamount. If you've seen a big cat recently, write in and tell us about it. And send us a picture if you have one, too. You know our email. It's vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Our managing producer is John Ahrens, and our producers are Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Anna Berg is our intern. Special thanks to Peter Angish and Juliana Vasquez for their help organizing and engineering our event at the Middlebury Town Hall Theater. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.